Good morning. And welcome to our Personal Theology Speaker Series. Our speaker this morning, Alex Pappas, has been coming here, he thinks, for like 12 to 14 years now in speaking. And usually his topic is a little bit different from today, so I'm excited about this talk. And he just returned recently from Turkey, where he and his wife live for over half the year. Alex was an instructor of world religions and psychology at the College of Alameda for over 30 years. He's been a longtime student of Vedanta, Theosophy, Alice A. Bailey, and non-dual paths. And he's an activist for universal health care. He is in the process of publishing a book called Heaven and Nirvana, Duality and Non-Duality in the World Religions. And this was an 8-plus-year project for him, and the book is 770 pages. So Alex's talk this morning follows right along with our presentation from last week, which was on Islam in America, except that Alex's talk will focus on Turkish politics and Islam, and Ataturk, Sharia, the sects Sunni, Alevi, and Sufi, Shia Iran, and Alawite Syria. So let's give a big welcome to Alex.
Thank you. This okay? You hear me? All right. Well, it's very nice to be back again, and I want to explain a little bit why Barbara asked me to talk about Turkish politics. I'm used to coming here all these years and talking about a specific religion or some path or something to that effect. My wife is Turkish. We've been together about 20 years. And during this past 20 years, I spent at least half my time in Turkey. We live in both Ankara and Istanbul. And happily for us, that we had not really, we've been 15, 20 minutes to drive away from all the bombings you hear about, even though the one at the train station is one where we go regularly to take the train back and forth to Istanbul. And it's unfortunate things are that way in the world. It's kind of weird to go through those kinds of experiences because for the first time in my life, several different areas, and I was sitting in a cafe, and I actually had this thought come up in my mind. What if somebody sets off a bomb? And I felt nervous, and I said, oh, forget it. Get into Nadal, Alex, immediately, and put it out of your life, because it contaminates the quality of your life. And it's a terrible thing. And then I think about certain parts of the world for the last 40, 50 years, people have had this awareness there might be the possibility of a bomb. And it was a real awakening for me in the sense it was no longer an intellectual concept, but an emotional experience. And let's all hope and pray that'll all come to an end. I just want to say one thing about my book, Commercial Break, I guess. It was printed in Turkey, but not officially published. And it's being published probably within a month. It'll be on Amazon. And this is the book. And even though it's a long one, I've been coming here all these years, and just about everything I ever said here is in this book. So if you like my song and dance or dog and pony show for the last 12 years, then the book might be of interest. But don't be intimidated by the length of it. If you read the first 30 pages of the book, then you can jump to any chapter that's of interest. And my main interest for those who've been coming here is to articulate duality and non-duality as salvation and liberation traditions, which we'll do next week when we cover Sufism. So I'll put that aside for now. I like to take questions while I'm speaking, but please, I don't like to hear a long speech because I don't have a lot of time, okay?
So if you have a question, you'll have to raise your hand and I'll bring you the microphone.
Yeah, right. Okay, I thought this talk is in two parts. I thought I would clarify some terminology. Some of you are familiar with it. But the first part will have to do with Islam in order to give a background to the political part of the talk, which will be the last half of the talk. And, of course, Islam's founder was Muhammad, who was born in 570 A.D. and died 62 years later, 632, in Mecca, Medina area. In Medina he died, but and in Saudi Arabia. And one thing Muhammad had, it's a revelatory religion like Judaism and Christianity. By revelation, I mean that the prophet of the religion had direct experiences of the supernatural, of God or the angels or whatever you want to say, okay? It's still a dualistic situation where there's the person getting the communication from the divine and the person and the divine itself. So there's two. There's a separation. It's not a unity. And this is true of Judaism with Noah and Abraham and Moses being getting revelations with God. Islam's a certain way the same. What's very special about Islam, though, that you must understand, that the over 20-year period, God through the angel Gabriel revealed his teachings to Muhammad. And this ended up being the holy book of Islam called the Quran. You're familiar with that. And one of the main tenets of the religion is that the Quran is the literal word of God, that it existed in eternity. It was not created in the moment. That's a big thing. Okay, then Muhammad, like all of us humans, had death. He died. What he didn't do is name a successor in a very concrete way. Now, those of the Shia tradition would yell at me right now saying, oh, yes, there was such and such a meeting where he did indicate who should be the next leader. That was his son-in-law and cousin at the same time, who was much younger than him, by the name of Ali. Okay. The main reason there are two sects, major sects in Islam, Shia and Sunni. Sunni means Orthodox. About 85% of the Muslims are Sunnis. And the main countries would be Turkey and Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim population in the world, is Indonesia. Now, I'm hesitating because I don't want to overwhelm you with detail. There was this fight. Should the successor to Muhammad be chosen by the community, little democracy, shall we say, or should the successor to Muhammad be of the bloodline of Muhammad, to wit, Ali, his cousin and son-in-law? So this is what we're talking about. It's sort of like the kings of England. You got to have a son, pass on the bloodline, then eventually they let the ladies in. Or can it be elected by the community, the ummah? It was decided at that time to go for the community selecting the succeeding leader of the Islamic community. And that was by an older person who led the prayers with Muhammad named Abu Bakr. And when he died a couple years later, he named Unaf and then Uthman. And then after 20 years, Ali was finally let in, and he was the fourth caliph. And you hear about this word caliph. Did this just go off? You can hear it. Okay, it sounded different to me. And a certain bitterness came out of this, and the community split. And the Shia say the people of the bloodline should lead the community. Well, in the year roughly 944, the last bloodline ended. If you look at the Shias, there are five groups. They're called Fivers, Seveners, and Twelvers. In other words, the people who are Shias who follow the Fiver tradition say the bloodline ended after five generations, seven generations, 12 generations. Most Shia are 12 generations, for example, Iran. And then who took over after the bloodline dissipated? Well, Shias developed this a tradition which you're familiar with. Imams, who are like the priests or the leaders, spiritual leaders, only their imams are not just regular ministers running the prayers and teaching the tradition. They're considered divinely inspired. And of course, in 1978, what this divinely inspired, infallible Iman took over in Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini. Okay, so that's that lineage. On the other hand, the Sunnis do not have that. Imams are respected and important, but they're sort of at the level of authority like we would regard a Catholic priest, a Protestant minister, a rabbi, etc., at that level. Okay? So the Shias have these major sects within the tradition, Fivers, Seveners, and Twelvers. The Sunnis do not have any particular sects. It's very interesting. However, they have four schools of law, and they're listed in your notes at the bottom of page one. Most of the points I'm making now are in the handout. And if you want a full dose, you can shell out $29 and get 800 pages. They have four schools of law. The most liberal one are the Hanafites, right there toward the bottom of the page. You all see that? And they're very liberal in quotes. And that's the tradition you see in Turkey and certain other countries listed there. It's very interesting to live in Turkey. Women are half the professional corps, half the doctors, lawyers, and professors are females. Half the country is very secular. I've seen mini skirts on the streets, and every once in a while, I see a veiled person. But the few women I see completely veiled, like you said, most of those are visitors from Saudi Arabia or other strict Islamic countries. They like to come to Turkey on vacation. The Russians used to like to come to Turkey on vacation, but no more since the plane got shot down. So that's what happened there. So then the Malachites and the Shafites, they're sort of in between. But at the top of page two, has to do with the religion, but political. In Saudi Arabia, the Hanbalites are very conservative, and they're really that school of law was put together a few hundred years ago by this fellow Wahhabi. You heard of the Wahhabis? Yeah, and the Salafists is a more correct name. And what's really interesting, in 1744, I got to back up, this is going to tie into the Sufis. Sufism, the mystical liberal tradition of Islam, was the main force in Islam from the time of Rumi, and those great poets and spiritual leaders from around 1100 or 1200 AD up until 1744. Sufism was the main tradition. After Wahhabi got into power and started spreading extreme conservative interpretation to the point that anybody who wasn't a member of his school of law, he considered a heretic. And Sufism was considered a heresy and had to go underground. Okay, but and now there was a deal made in 1744 that Mojave said to Saud of the Saud family, look, you let me be the religious leader in Saudi Arabia, and I will support you and your family to be the political leaders in Saudi Arabia. And this deal still continues to this day. And what's a serious problem politically in the world, and it's an issue with the United States State Department in Saudi Arabia, is that Wahhabism is funded worldwide with Saudi oil money. And it's a very extremist point of view. I'm not saying their schools and things all are breeding bombing jihadists, but the probabilities are, well, it makes you worry. And this appears and is discussed in the American news. Have any of you seen that? You noticed it? Yeah, it's out there. And that's where it goes. And there's a quotation I won't read there between Wahhabi and the first Saudi person where they're making the deal. I thought you might be interested in that. Okay, so we have these two sects, Shias and Sunnis. Now, every religion tells its followers how to be good and how not to be bad, right? And the in Judaism, you have the 613 laws in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, most of them in Leviticus. In Islam, you have Sharia, which has four sources of what constitutes, or the sources of the law itself. The Quran only has a limited amount of the Sharia in it, the do's and the don'ts. But that's considered the prime source. Anything in the Quran rules. Nobody should interpret it except liberally. The second most important source of Sharia is the life of Muhammad. That's called the Sunnah. Okay, now, what Muhammad did and approved of directly, overtly, or tacitly is the way Muslims today should live their life. Well, how do we know how Muhammad lived? That was, you know, mere 1,400 years ago. Well, of course, there were great scholars and followers who went to great length to contact several hundred years ago people who knew Muhammad, especially Muhammad's 10 companions, and they developed and what's called the Hadith. That's why you see here I have Sunni/Hadith. If we go to page 1, the Hadith is a very important term. The Hadith is the written statement of how Muhammad lived his life. Now, the Sunnis have one of their greatest writers of the Hadith is a man named Bukhari. Bukhari is a big name. 600 years ago, and it's said that he made 300,000 interviews to put together his teachings. You've heard of the five pillars of Islam, the five things an Islamist must do to practice the religion. Those five pillars are found in one of the hadiths of Bukhari. Okay? And so it's very important. Now, of course, the Shias say, hey, we're not going to go with the Sunni hadiths because they leave out Ali. So the Shias have their own hadiths. They got four of them written by the three Muhammads. And I can't remember their names, who put out four hadiths. And those are the ones that are used by the Shia. But the point is, the Quran and how Muhammad lived his life are the two main sources of Sharia that you hear about all the time. Okay? And the two secondary sources are a consensus of the community. Something may come up, and you have to discuss it, and what the consensus of the community is decided upon. Well, how do you do that when you have 1.5 billion Muslims living all over the world? Okay? So that becomes a delegated thing. And I don't want to get into too much because I'm at the time. And so consensus. And the fourth source is the interpretation of the law, the ittijad. and or reasoning. And again, the technicalities, the Sunnis approve a certain type of logic and way to approach this, and it's a little different than the Shias. You want to torture yourself with the details? Okay. And but this is important. For example, if you steal, what happens to you and get caught? All right? That's very straight. Not so. If you steal a loaf of bread during a famine and you're desperate, they won't cut your arm off. This is a ruling. It's interpreted as it goes down. It's very, the Sharia is a little bit like the Jewish Talmud, which is made up of the Mishnah, the written, the 613 laws summarized, plus the Gemara. They put it, and it's an ongoing thing. The Talmud is still being put together through interpretations. Same thing with the Shia. Sharia. So there are these other qualifications. There are four of them. If you want the details, in the not-so-holy book. Or, cheaper, go online with Wiki. Wiki has a lot of good stuff on Islam. Very good. Okay. So, does anybody have any questions? Short ones about Sunnis and Sharia. Anything at all? Was I clear to you and make sense to you? Okay. Yes.
Has anyone ever entertained the possibility that Muhammad was lying?
I will now, as anybody considered, everybody heard that lie? I will now duck that question. Yes, everybody, this is, yeah, of course, you know, and we can say that about any spiritual leader in any religion. Zoroaster claimed he experienced the divine. Was he lying? Or was he nuts? Or was he... and just deluded, a little psychotic. This is the thing you have to ask about people who experience the other. There are three possibilities as far as I can tell. They're liars. They need a therapist and a little Prozac. They're having an experience, but they're deluded. Or it really happened. And if you're a person of faith, you accept Muhammad and the Quran. If you're a traditional Christian, if you're an Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, like I was baptized in, you believe that Jesus was the literal Son of God. Okay? That's the article of faith. And I'll just leave it at that. Okay, let's go to, by the way, did you all get the map that Barbara so lovely printed out? Get the microphone here, Barbara.
Would it be safe to say that this is the difference between the two sects, Sunni and Shia, is similar to how Christian and Judaism is different? Yeah. Would you say the difference between Sunni and Shia is similar to how Christianity with Judaism and Christianity are different, or are they more vastly different?
Well, the main reason that Christianity is very Jewish, and the main reason it broke off with Judaism was St. Paul went out and said you can convert from being a Gentile to a Christian without becoming Jewish and circumcised first, then you know, that broke it. That was one of the main things. It was a big debate. And it was not really a debate about the divinity of Jesus. That was not the thing. So I would say no, not exactly. Not exactly. Now, the Shia, the main country that we deal with in the newspapers and on CNN, is Iran, okay? And in Yemen. And, of course, the Saudis are down there in Yemen fighting, you know? That's what's behind us. Now, what about Syria and Assad? Well, the Syrian constitution says who's ever the president of Syria must be a Muslim. But Assad family are Alawites. A big issue, because a lot of people say they're heretics. Well, some kind of a deal was made, and I'll refer you to page... Let's see here. I think it's the third page. At the top it says there are approximately 600,000 Alawites. There's a paragraph there where in 1974 an imam in Lebanon made it official and he said the Alawites are considered Shias and therefore the Assad family are Muslims and can be the rulers of Syria. Now, how did they get him to do that and all that? Well, that's another big story. You can check that out, okay? Last night, how many of you saw Mr. Smith Goes to Washington on KQED? Well, I did too, and of course I thought of Bernie, and I thought about some of these other deals here in my notes of what goes on. And I'm sort of skipping over because there's some other points I really want to get to. I don't have a watch. How are you on the time?
I'll keep track of your time. You're okay.
25 after. Okay, we're okay. We're okay. So they're the Alawites. Now, there's another important group of in Turkey called the Alevi. And they are very unusual. They don't go to a mosque. They have a camevi. Cami, it means mosque or holy, a place of meeting place. Evi means house in Turkish. And if there's a C without a tail, it's pronounced as a J. And you walk into one of those places, and the first picture you see is Ataturk, who was a secularist and wanted total separation of church and state and what have you. Then some other pictures of holy people and very often including Jesus. It's very interesting. And they were persecuted for many years in Turkey, but things have eased up. But who knows what tomorrow will bring, and we'll get into that later. So these are important things, and do not equate Alevi with Alawites in Syria. Totally different. Okay? Now, at the bottom of the page, and sort of summary of the start, is an introduction to the political part of this talk. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to give you my layperson's political view of all these things. I'm not a political science expert on the Middle East. I just live there a lot, a long time, and exposed to it. And my family, through my wife there, they're all Ataturk lefties who are very secular and very political, and we talk a lot. So I'm not saying I hope I'm accurate. I hope I'm not biased, but of course we all are, whether we like it or not. Okay, here's my view of the root causes of the Middle East crisis. Muhammad didn't name a leader, a successor, and that led to this split, which has caused endless wars and problems. And by the way, I was really shocked when Marvin Pearl, remember him? He was Bush's advisor, and he said, oh, when we go into Iraq, the American soldiers will be given flowers and they'll love to have us there. And then somebody said, what about the Sunni Shia thing? Oh, in recent history there haven't been any troubles between them. That's the kind of advice that was coming out of the national security advisors. Sunnis and Shias have been each other's throats for years. And prejudice, and it's very unfortunate. And anyway, I got that off my chest. Another thing that caused problems here, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a conscious rejection of modernization by most Islamic leaders. They were afraid if their countries were modernized and industrialized, it would undermine the theocratic religious culture. And so that's one of the reasons most Islamic countries are way behind technologically compared to the West. And this is a really serious problem. And you have these incredible unemployment rates and what have you. There was no infrastructure, for example, to absorb the oil money to translate that into building industries and what have you in the country. The people weren't trained. Now, that's being changed now, but it's very unfortunate. Number three, the Treaty of Versailles plus other treaties, which I list later, which I consider the biggest political diplomatic fiasco disaster of the 20th century, giving rise to Hitler, and the carving up of the Ottoman Empire. You know, that was all the Ottoman Empire, which was on the German side in World War I. And so this Middle East, there were several other treaties I'll get to. The French and English, I put it on them, not Woodrow Wilson. They carved up the Middle East. Lebanon was created. Iraq was created. Syria was created. All these countries were created at World War I time. And, of course, they were divided up without regard to where the Sunnis lived and the Shias lived. It's sort of like what the colonialists did in Africa. They carved up Africa with a total disregard of tribal lines and what have you. And you have people in different countries in Africa who don't like each other, and they're killing each other. And it's going on. And it's very unfortunate. So there's no free lunch. The greed and the self-interest cause a great many problems. I went right into the fourth point about the Ottoman Empire. Let's go to the next page. Am I going too fast, Sir Clay? Okay. Nobody's going to sleep yet, so I guess I'm all right. Okay. In 5 minutes, I like to cover 2,000 years of world history. And we will now indulge me. You know, spiritual growth means your ego gets reduced. And I thought, hey, mine must have swelled up when I typed this. We're at the top where it says history, Rome, Byzantine, and Ottoman empires. And there's a list of dates.
Page 4.
I'm sorry I didn't number the pages. Another further. I did? Oh, Barbara, thank you. I didn't do it. Mine aren't numbered. She's one step ahead of me. Okay, good. Is that page 4? Okay, great. We're together. Okay. You all heard of Rome. You all heard of Julius Caesar and ending the Republic, and that cost him his life. And then the Roman Empire began under Augustus. And remember I, Claudius series? That's when this all comes into play here. And they had this Roman Empire. Now, let's go down to 395. You all see that? Very important. The Roman Empire was divided administratively. It was just unwieldy. So the western part of the Roman Empire, headquarters in Rome, Italy, okay, and didn't have an Italy then, and the eastern part of the Roman Empire in Constantinople, Istanbul today, okay? Two things. Okay, now, in 476, the western Roman Empire went kaput. The Vandals, the Visigoths, the Goths came down, and you know, they ended the Western Roman Empire. However, the Eastern Roman Empire survived. After a couple hundred years, the name was changed to Byzantine, okay? And you had the Byzantine, about 1,200 years of Byzantine Empire, which ended in 1453 when the Ottoman Turks, Muslims, conquered Constantinople. Actually, it was over. It was the Byzantine Empire was quite big. You could Google some maps and show how big it was. It was very important. By the time of 1453, it was just really a glorified enclave in what's now Istanbul. And if you visit Istanbul, you can see the original walls. They're incredibly thick, and the city always held out. But in the end, the city refused to surrender. Mamet offered them, if you surrender, we won't slaughter you. They wouldn't surrender, and there was a terrible slaughter. One of the most famous Byzantine churches in Istanbul, you probably all know the name, Hagia Sophia, and a lot of people went there to pray, and they were slaughtered there, and it's unfortunate. Now, we have this Ottoman Empire, which started in 1299, about 150 years before it conquered, and it lasted to 1924. So the Ottoman Empire was as big as the Roman Empire, and it lasted 600 years. Everybody got that? In 1914, it was dying. It was called the sick man of Europe, the last 100-odd years of its existence. And the and at the Treaty of Versailles, it was carved up to suit the needs of the Western powers. Except it didn't work with what we call Turkey today. I'll explain this. Let's see. Just below I show the Treaty of Versailles, the Treaty of San Remo, and the Treaty of Sevres. Those are the three disasters because they planted the seeds of a lot of the problems we have today. Now, and then the last three lines there are, I would call the Turkish Revolution and Ataturk. Let's jump to page 5 first, just a second. You see the photograph there in the center? Oh, well, maybe I'm... thank you, thank you. That helps. Oh, I see, you got... Yeah, I beg your pardon, page 6. I'm sorry. It's different. Thank you for this. I should have had this. On page 6, I just want to make a couple comments. We all know Peter O'Toole is the reincarnation of Lawrence of Arabia, right? And he was a great fighter for the British because the British were fighting the Ottoman Empire, which had joined the side of the Germans in World War I. And he enlisted the support of the Arabs, and they had a lot of victories and what have you. And Lawrence really wanted a unified Arab world from the Mediterranean all the way to the Indian border. He thought that would be the best way, a unified kingdom with autonomous reasons for Shia and Shiite. And he thought Faisal would be the best person to take over. And Faisal was quite an open person. He even accepted conditionally the Balfour Agreement. He would have created, or if his cohorts would let him, an Israel at that time. And of course, when England and France had other treaties decided to carve up the Middle East, this went all kaput. And of course, you all know Israel wasn't created until after World War II. Okay, and I just thought you'd like to see a picture. You can read that if you like. I'm going to use this other one. Okay. Let's go to page bottom of 4. I presume all of you have heard of Ataturk? Yeah, okay. The Turkish people were very lucky at that time to have such a leader. Ataturk was intellectually a very high IQ, genius type of guy, outstanding student, literally. He was a very excellent military leader. He, you know, the whole story of Gallipoli. You got, by the way, the Battle of Gallipoli is 1 year long. It's not just that horrible beach scene in the movie where everybody gets machine gunned to death. It's the Dardanelles Straits, you know, from the Mediterranean leading into the Black Sea. And if you visit Turkey, you can do a tour down there. The battle lasted for a year for that peninsula. The Allies lost. It was Winston Churchill's biggest mistake to try and take it. Ataturk was in charge of the Ottoman forces at that time. And there's a famous story. He almost got killed, but his watch stopped a bullet from going into his body. And that's in a museum if you want to go see it. And the point is, roughly 500,000 men on each side died in that battle. I don't know who you call a winner. Close to 1,000,000 men died, and they're all buried on this long peninsula. And I visited it, and I just shook my head. I thought, my God, somebody makes a political military decision, and 1,000,000 young people die. It's just really interesting. Okay, now at these treaties, they wanted to. Let's look at your color map, okay? You see little Turkey there up at the top? The top map with a little red star? Well, where that little red star is where Ankara is. Ankara is the capital of Turkey. It's about 6 million people. It's like Sacramento. It's all the government buildings are there. It's a university town. They have about a dozen universities there, about four or five of them teaching English, and blah, blah, blah. And that's where it is. What the Treaty of Versailles and these other treaties wanted to define as Turkey would be a little bit south of that red dot up to the Black Sea coast and a little bit east and west of that, with no access to the Aegean, Istanbul not included, and nothing on the south shore. Well, this didn't sit well with a group of Turkish fighters. So there's a big story. In effect, they assembled an army in Ankara, and they defeated the army. The British talked the Greeks into being their soldiers, along with the Italians. And it's a big story, a big fight. And in the final battle at the Saqqara River, the forces were defeated. And it was such a terrible defeat. The Greek general that was in charge of the forces there, when he went back to Greece, he was court-martialed and shot. It was hard business. And then the last serious fight was the taking of Izmir. Smyrna is on the west coast of Turkey. It was a bloodbath. They hung the Greek bishop at that time. It was just awful. You can see, the Ataturk and his forces defeated these people, and modern Turkey's borders were defined at the Treaty of Lausanne. Lausanne is in Switzerland. And that's how this country was redefined, because they didn't go along with the way the Western powers had carved it up. They were going to divide. France and Italy were going to get parts of what is now modern Turkey, etc. You can read about that at Wiki. I haven't got time to go into it, but you all get the picture. And now this is very important for current Turkish politics. Ataturk was adamant to separate church and state. He didn't want a theocracy. He knew he had to allow religion to exist, but he kept it to a minimum. He did something. He closed down even the Sufi centers. They were oppressed. But he was a great believer in women's rights. He gave women the vote and required they go to school. His adopted daughter, Sabiha Gurchen, she was the first woman pilot of Turkey. Istanbul's second largest airport is Sabiha Gurchen Havalimani Airport. And he was a great reformer. I consider him a revered, benign dictator at the time, even though there was a parliament. And if you go to Ankara, to the Ulus district, they have all the original buildings where the first Parliament met, they have mock-up models like the Tussaud Wax Museum of Ataturk standing up in front of the group like I'm with you and what have you. It's great. It's very interesting. And so Ataturk party prevailed. Ataturk died young. He wasn't even 60. He smoked too much, and he liked Uzur Reiki. And he had a lot of stress in his life. He had a tragic life as well as... But he was a wonderful, smart political leader. I mean, everybody. And he was very open. He wanted to be friends with Greece. Venizelos was the Greek leader at the time. He invited him to Turkey. Venizelos came to Turkey, and he was honored. And and Ataturk knew French. He was very... with it. And he believed in peace, productivity, and equal rights for men and women. Now,
Alex, it's 10:45, so just
10:45. I got what, 5 minutes?
Well, yeah.
10 minutes.
We would have 10
okay,
minutes.
Okay, I'll say a couple things and maybe I'll take a question or two. Erdogan is the prime minister is the president of Turkey. He had been the prime minister for a long time. To understand what's going on now are 2 points. How many of you heard of Gulen? Where does he live? Pennsylvania. Gulen. Who's this guy Gulen? You must Google Gulen or read what I got there. Gulen was a buddy of Erdogan's, and they were... had the same views spiritually and politically, and they were buddies together. They had a falling out. Gulen headed to America. He has a big following in Turkey, and his followers control a lot of newspapers and media. And you heard about the two reporters on trial. They work for a Gulen newspaper, which was attacking Erdogan. It's a whole big thing going back and forth. Erdogan's also oppressing other newspapers as well. So that's very important. And just the other day, the Prime Minister of Turkey resigned, Ahmet Davutoğlu. By the way, if you see a G in a name, don't just pretend it's not there, it's silent. And he's an academic, and he was really starting to resist Erdogan trying to make the presidency very strong and diminish the power of the parliament, and he got kicked out. As of May 20th, he'll be out. I'm sorry I'm so rushed.
I'm going to need to leave to do the ushering, but I have one question.
I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
I'm going to need to leave shortly to do some ushering. That's why I'm asking the question now. You, there are many causes of the problems in the Middle East, and as you correctly point out, the Sunni-Shia split is one of them. To what extent did the invasion of Iraq, George W. Bush's invasion create the current problem?
Well, the invasion of Iraq, the Sunnis, a minority under Hussein, he was suppressing successfully the majority Shiite community in Iraq. And then after the Americans occupied Iraq in that war, there was a very bloody decision made where the American commanders told Hussein, General, it's okay for you guys to fly armed helicopters. And they did, and they massacred a lot of Shia. The Shia were starting to take over Iraq at that time after the Americans went in. This is a big subject, but that was the fatal decision that kept the Shia secondary. And of course, Maliki came in, and he's a Shia, and he was a terrible leader, in my opinion, because he didn't try to integrate the Sunnis with him. And Iraq's a disaster. Sorry, I've been 1 minute. Somebody else want to ask something? Over here.
So, why is Islam so resistant to the existence of Israel in the Middle East?
Another small question. Two people want the same piece of land equals big trouble, right? And you can go into a whole lot of reasons why I'm right and you're wrong, okay? And I can't really answer that in 1 minute, but you know the history and this. It was felt that it was You know the arguments of the Palestinians say we were ripped off. The Jews said we had to survive. We had to go to some place the Western world wouldn't take us when Hitler was sticking us in the concentration camps. And the West refused to let Jewish immigrants into America. Remember the Ship of Fools? I love FDR, but I thought that was a horrible thing. We rejected them. The anti-Semitism was very strong in the Western world. And so you got this, who's right? I'm not smart enough to
answer
that.
But is there a religious component to it? Like,
I don't think religion has anything really to do with it. I really don't. I think it's political survival. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they're all first cousins called the Abrahamic traditions. And they have the basic same model. And they all say, and I'll leave this thought with you, God, the divine, is not understandable by the conceptual mind. Is beyond mine. You have to have some kind of transcendent experience to understand God. So we're all ignorant of God. But I want you folks to know, Alex Pappas' ignorance is better than yours, so you do what I tell you. You get what I mean? And then people go to war over whose ignorance is the best.
In terms of the rise of Erdogan, can you explain the base of his support within the country, particularly its class base, and also his move to end the secularism of Turkey.
Oh.
Okay. Okay.
Erdogan.
I'll repeat it. In terms of Erdogan, could you describe the base of his support within Turkey, particularly class-wise, and his move against secularism?
Thank you. I left out a very important point, and that question reminds me, and maybe I'll answer it. My opinion. Erdogan was the former mayor of Istanbul. He was a businessman. He knows how to run an economy. Real income in Turkey over the last 15 or 16 years has doubled real income. When you double the take-home pay of a lot of people, you get a lot of political power. And that's a fact. Infrastructure in Turkey is growing by leaps and bounds. They have starting to build freeways, high-speed trains, everything we're not doing here. However, it's a repressive regime, no such thing as freedom of the press, etc. You see, it's just like Hitler ran the railroads. I see Erdogan as trying to be another Putin. My guess is the Turkish government will end up being structured like the Russian government, along kind of in that direction. And somebody here?
In 10 words or less? No.
A little louder.
Okay. The question simply is, with our election coming up, do you have any advice for the candidates?
You mean in America?
Yes.
I love Bernie, and I'll vote for Hillary if she gets it.
No, I didn't mean to ask who you're for. What should their position be with regard to America in the Middle East? Should the Americans continue to be involved in the Middle East to the extent that we are, or should we withdraw?
You have no choice. You have to be involved. I tell you what I worry about a lot. A lot of atomic bombs are stored in Pakistan and other countries, and I don't know if they're being well. The security of them is very well, and I'm concerned some nuts are going to get a hold of them and use them.
We only have time for one more question.
Yeah, I would like to ask, do you think the army has been completely defanged in Turkey? The army. Is the Turkish army...
Oh, the army.
Yes.
Yes, it's been defanged. You know, the Turkish army always had coups up until about 15 years ago. And it was kind of ironic. The army was very liberal and supported Ataturk's policies. And when they saw the country getting out of control or too religious, they would do a coup. A few people would die. And now, as opposed to the army in Chile, which was very right wing, got Pinochet in. You see, it was kind of ironic that the army was the good guys. But anyway, they were defanged several years ago. And a lot of pro-Erdogan, et cetera, people are in the higher ranks of the echelon. Don't look to the army to do a coup. My two cents.
Okay. But look at the map. There is no mention of Palestine. And Palestine is a big factor in what is happening in the Middle East and what has been happening. There is no Palestine. And with regard to the question, why are people against Israel? Because Israel came and took the land of the Palestinians and continues to expand. And the Palestinians became homeless.
I should have used the map that showed Palestine. Sorry. Okay. Well, thank you, and I hope you come.
Thank you, Alex.
Talk about Sufism next week. Thank you.